Okay, so I think we can probably start. My idea for this evening's talk is to talk about secular Buddhism and what secular Buddhism is all about and what it actually means and whether it is really necessary, whether it really adds anything to the world. One of the interesting things as we see Buddhism expanding in the West and taking roots in the Western world and outside of traditional Buddhist countries is, of course, that Buddhism then takes new forms usually. Whenever it goes somewhere else, it takes new forms. It adapts to the environment in a new country, whether it's the physical environment or the culture, whatever it is. And we're seeing, of course, the same thing happening here when Buddhism is coming to the West. We're seeing it adapting and changing because of Western culture or whatever it is. And one of those adaptations that have happened in the West is this idea of secular Buddhism. And this has arisen, I think, because many people with a Western background, they have often rejected their own native religion. Myself, for example, I was baptized as a baby. Of course, you don't really know that you get baptized. This happens to you. But I never really had any kind of relationship with Christianity. Christianity never meant anything in my life at all. And so I sort of was never religious until I came to Buddhism. And suddenly you are kind of branded as religious because you are a Buddhist. And many people in the West feel more comfortable with this idea of secular Buddhism rather than what you might call traditional Buddhism, which they then consider more religious in a sense. Of course, the idea of the word secular is the opposite of religious, right? So it's like the anti-religious Buddhism, as opposed to religious Buddhism, basically. Yeah. But the problem with this is that as we do these kind of things, as we establish perhaps a new kind of variety of Buddhism in the West, what we're also doing is that we're starting to split Buddhism apart into subgroups. And of course, the history of Buddhism is basically a history of splittage, right? Of things, people moving apart in one way because they have different ideas, because they want to do things differently. And if you look in the Buddhist world, there are so many subgroups, so many different ideas, so many different ways of looking at the Buddhist teachings. And we are already so incredibly split. Do we really need to split further? Do we need to have the split between secular Buddhism and traditional Buddhism? Is it really required? And so I want to look at whether there really is a need for this kind of thing. Is the Buddhism that we have already, coming here to Dhammaloka Center, isn't this perhaps already secular enough? In fact, the way that secular Buddhism is often defined by secular Buddhists, I want to ask the question, is it really Buddhism at all? I think this is a very important question that we need to look at, because Buddhism must mean a certain set of ideas. And if you move too far away from those ideas, probably you don't have Buddhism anymore, right? There must be something that we understand by the Buddha's teachings. You go beyond that, you've got something else, and it isn't Buddhism anymore. So to look at this, I think one of the starting points here to understand whether there is a need for secular Buddhism is, of course, to discuss, first of all, is Buddhism really a religion in the first place? And this is a question that people often ask. They ask, is Buddhism a religion? Of course, Ajahn Brahm usually answers. His answer is, well, it is for tax purposes. That's kind of his answer to that one. Very cheeky. But I think we need to go a bit further than that. I'm not sure that's going to get us very far here. So is Buddhism a religion? And the first thing that always occurs to you when you ask this question, you look around the Buddhist world, and you see that a lot of people around the Buddhist world, they act as if Buddhism is a religion, right? If you look at how people act, very often they do lots of rituals. This is a kind of classical religious thing, like heaps of rituals, often without any particular meaning, without any kind of purpose to it apart from the ritual itself. That's one thing. Yeah. Another thing which happens in the Buddhist world is that people pray, right? As if Buddhism is a religion of prayer, as if there is someone to pray to. So people pray to the Buddha, almost like people pray to a god in a theistic religion. But, there is no Buddha there. You can't really pray to the Buddha, right? He's gone. He died 2,500 years ago. So it's a kind of it shows you the shift in attitude that has happened in Buddhism over 2,500 years. The Buddha was a human being. Now he's become somebody you pray to. So this is the first thing, is that many people treat Buddhism, they act upon Buddhism as if it was a religion. Is that right? And to me, Buddhism is not how people actually act, how they practice. If you want to find out what Buddhism really is, you have to ask, what did the Buddha teach? What are his teachings? Did the Buddha regard his teaching as a religion? How did the Buddha look at this? That is the question we need to ask, not how average or ordinary Buddhists practice this particular teaching here. So what did the Buddha say about Buddhism? And there's a number of points that I just want to make fairly briefly about how he taught. And the very first thing which is interesting about the Buddha, of course, his teaching is often known as the Dhamma, right? Now this word Dhamma is an ancient Indian word which basically means nature. It means what nature is like, what the world is like, right? It doesn't mean, it can mean teaching as well, but the root meaning is like nature. And if it is nature that we're talking about, we're not really talking about a religion anymore in that sense. Usually the distinction in kind of Western ideas is that you have like science on one side and you have religion on the other, and they're not really compatible, right? But in ancient India, there wasn't that distinction. It wasn't like science over here, religion over there. It was just Dhamma, and Dhamma meant nature. Just like the idea of science is to investigate nature, the idea of Dhamma was also to investigate nature or to reflect on nature. So there wasn't that distinction. And of course, I think it is very unfortunate that today we have this massive gulf between science and religion, or science and so-called religion. Is it really necessary? I think that for any person who is a seeker of truth, and to me that is what Buddhism in large part is about, understanding the world, understanding your mind, seek for reality, you cannot really afford to have that distinction between science and your spiritual practice. They should actually go together, they should merge together. And I think we need to get back, ideally, to this idea that they had in ancient India, that Dhamma, it is nature that we're seeking. We're trying to understand reality. And this dichotomizing between science and spiritual life is very unfortunate. The distinction between spiritual life and science is not that they should be opposites. The distinction is just the method. The method of inquiry is different. In science, you do research that can be replicated by somebody else, third-party research. In meditation, we're looking inwards, trying to understand ourselves, right? These things should not be opposed to each other. Rather, they are more like complementary. And we need to learn from science as Buddhists. And perhaps science can also learn something from the introspection of the Buddhist path itself. So they should actually go hand in hand and should be complementary, not opposed to each other. So Dhamma, Buddhism, is nature. It's about the world. It's not something, a theory, an idea in somebody's head, a tradition. It's actually about how the world functions. So that is the first point about Dhamma, how the Buddha basically taught his teachings. The second, one of the other things that I always found interesting about the Buddha, one of the last things that he said as he was dying, was that he said, you know, the monks were coming to the Buddha and presumably the nuns as well, and they were saying, but you're dying, what are we going to do? We're going to be left alone. You are the master, you are our teacher. Suddenly everything is going to disappear. How terrible. And people were crying and pulling out their hair. Which is natural, right? You can imagine having a Buddha around, someone who is very, very beautiful person, very pure, very wonderful, very wise. And suddenly someone you have been relying on for your whole life for spiritual guidance, somebody they're passing away, they're disappearing. And of course, you're going to feel terrible. It's like having a close family member, someone who is not even just an ordinary family member, but a very special one passing away. You feel a sense of emptiness, right? Something is going away. But what the Buddha said, when they said, what shall we do now? He didn't say, you should find another guru. You should choose another leader. He didn't say that at all. He said that you should depend on yourself. You should be islands unto yourself. You should be refuges unto yourself. Does that sound like a religion? To me, it doesn't sound like a religion at all. The idea of religion is very often that you should rely on God, right? If you are a theistic religion, God will look after you. All you have to do is pray enough and believe enough. And if you do that, your actions aren't that important. The most important thing is your faith. That will actually take you all the way. Or in other religions they say, rely on the guru, right? The guru will look after you. If only that were the case. Too often the guru does the opposite of looking after you, and he takes advantage of you instead, right? So this is the beauty of the Buddhist path, is that you are in charge. It is your responsibility. It is your life. Your life is not in the hands of somebody else who can sort of boss you around and tell you what to do. You are in charge of your own spiritual life. Isn't that great? Isn't that a wonderful teaching? It's so empowering. It's like, if I do the right thing, if I practice the right way, things will go well for me. I can actually look after this. I don't really need to rely on anything else. Yes, I will use the Buddhist teachings as a guide, not relying on any particular individual. In the end of the day, I will use these wonderful teachings as a guide, but it's up to me to make sure that this works out. It's so empowering that we are in charge rather than something outside of us being in charge. So again, to me, this doesn't sound like much like a religion. It sounds like something which rather makes very good sense and whereby you are not so vulnerable to all the problems that can arise otherwise if you're too dependent on something outside of you. So that is another way the Buddha taught. Another way, again, is of course, if you look at one of the most central of the Buddha's teachings is the idea of the Four Noble Truths, right? The idea of suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering, right? The Four Noble Truths. Now, if you're thinking about those Four Noble Truths, okay, suffering, right? Okay, fair enough. It's easy enough to relate to. Cause of suffering, end of suffering, path leading to the end of suffering. Again, it's not particularly religious. It's pragmatic. It's about our lives. It's about what our lives are like. And one of the metaphors that the Buddha uses to explain the Four Noble Truths is the metaphor, the medical metaphor. So the medical metaphor is that there is a problem, right? There is suffering here. There's a problem out there. It's like an illness, a cancer, whatever. Then there is the diagnosis. The diagnosis is that there is a cause for this problem. You suffer for a reason. Just like the illness you have might be for a reason, bacteria, virus or whatever. In exactly the same way, there is a reason why there is suffering in the world, why we have personal suffering. This is the diagnosis. The third one is that there is a cure. It's not one of those incurable illnesses. There is a cure to this illness. And the last one is, of course, the medicine that you have to take. The medicine being the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Again, it's almost like scientific. It's scientific. It's very similar to what the medical science at that day, how they would diagnose an illness, and very much how we still do that to the present day. Again, not very religious, pragmatic, right? Looking at life for what it is, trying to find a solution to the problems. Another way that the Buddha taught, and again you find this in particular in the suttas that the Buddha taught towards the end of his life, and one of the things that the Buddha taught was something known as the 37 aids to awakening or to enlightenment. These are called the Bodhipakya Dhammas in the Pali language. And this shows another aspect of the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha said that if there's anything you're going to remember from my teachings, this is the core aspect of the teachings. So remember this, if you remember this, and you bring that into the future with you, as long as these things are there, the Dhamma, my teachings, will be lasting for a long time. So what are these things, these 37 things? They are the Noble Eightfold Path, the factors of awakening, seven factors of awakening, the spiritual faculties, the four focuses of mindfulness, the four right efforts. This is all about the path, right? Probably many of you will recognize the things I'm talking about straight away. It's all about the path. So the Buddha's teachings is all about the path. He's saying this is what you should remember, and everything else is really not that relevant. So again, it has this incredible pragmatic approach. It's about how you live your life, how you practice your life, and how you actually get on this path and do the practice all the way to the end. That is what it's all about. And one of the last things that the Buddha also said in the suttas about his teachings, which I find again is very, again has this pragmatic idea about it, this non-religious idea about it. He said, I can summarize my teaching in two phrases, in two words, that there is suffering and that there is the end of suffering. I think he said, my teaching is only about two things, suffering and the end of suffering, right? That's all it is, suffering and the end of suffering. Again, very pragmatic, very straight to the point. Now, if you think about that, all that there is suffering and the end of suffering. It seems almost too obvious, right? Okay, so you meditate. You may have felt perhaps tonight that you got rid of a little bit of suffering through meditation practice. Maybe you felt better after you meditated than before. Is that working? No, I don't think so. Is it? Better. Okay, it's better. Somebody turn it down. Okay, good. Okay. I thought I was suffering arising, but it wasn't. It was it was happiness arising. Okay. But it's almost too simple, right? You have the idea of suffering. We all know that there is suffering. We all know that there is the end of suffering sometimes. But actually, of course, what this also points us to is something more profound. If the Buddha says, all I teach is suffering and the end of suffering, it must mean that there's something more to this than we actually normally understand, right? When the Buddha says that there is the end of suffering, actually that is pretty profound, because we don't understand normally in our ordinary lives. It's very hard to relate to a complete end of suffering. Suffering is always kind of there in the background. It always comes back almost at any time. Somebody says the wrong thing. You hit a part of your body and it hurts, right? It's always so close. It's always kind of ready to arise, often at the very time when you least need it. So, because of that, at this particular point, we're already kind of starting to move towards what some people call the more religious aspect of Buddhism, because we're moving towards something which is beyond, outside of our ordinary understanding. So what I want to do now, basically so far, I've mentioned some of the ideas, how the Buddha spoke about his own teaching and how he taught the Dhamma. Now I want to move towards those things that Buddhism is often criticized for being too religious. And of course, one of those things that will be no surprise for you is, of course, the idea of rebirth, right? Many people in the world reject this idea of rebirth. And because they reject the idea of rebirth, when they come to Buddhism, they say, there's rebirth there. I don't like the idea of rebirth. So that is not part of Buddhism. And then they read the Buddhist teaching in such a way that they marginalize the idea of rebirth. Is that right? Can you do that? This, I think, is one of the very important questions. I think that the first reason why people put this aside, the idea of rebirth, because they think that in our modern world we cannot believe in such a thing. It doesn't fit with our modern worldview. And for many people, that is probably true. It doesn't fit with a modern worldview. But the reality is that, first of all, there are actually an enormous amount of people in the world who actually have a personal sense that there is such a thing as rebirth. I remember seeing some amazing statistics saying that there is something like 25% of people across cultures, across religions, across even non-religions, think that there is such a thing as rebirth. It doesn't matter if they are atheists, if they are agnostics, it's still very much part of how people often look at the world. So what kind of arguments do people have when they say that there is no... What are the arguments that are being used? And I would like to, this may seem a little bit theoretical, but I think it's quite useful to look at some of these arguments. Because most of the arguments that you find that are kind of negative about rebirth are essentially theoretical arguments. One of them is, of course, to say that, well, from the scientific point of view, we cannot see anything like the mind, right? And of course, if you're going to have rebirth, you're going to have a mind that sort of moves on from this life onto a future one. There has to be somehow a distinction between the coarse physical body we have now and the mind, which then can move on into a future existence. And then they say, because we cannot see this, because we haven't actually observed it, it must be something that we reject. And then they forget that science itself has evolved over hundreds of years, right? Often changing, often coming up with new insights, often coming up with new understandings. And when you look carefully at the scientific kind of understanding in the present day, you will see that the vast majority of scientists, they say, we don't actually understand the mind. The mind is something completely unknown to us. Science is the understanding, basically, of material phenomena in the world. And the mind is like a blank. They call it the hard problem, this idea of consciousness and the mind. And once science admits that it doesn't understand something, there is no obligation for us to then follow along with the scientific idea that there cannot be any rebirth, because science itself doesn't understand what's going on. It gives us a bit of leeway to actually consider the Buddha's teachings in a different way, in a new light. It is not as clear-cut anymore. So this is the first thing. We have to basically know what is going on to some extent in the scientific field. So there is no obligation there from a scientific point of view not to believe in rebirth. To give another example of one of these theoretical arguments that is being used sometimes to say that rebirth is an impossibility. And this is like a philosophical argument. And a philosophical argument is an argument that goes back to this idea of the distinction between mind and body. And the first person who made that distinction, you may remember, was Descartes, the French philosopher, the one who said, I think, therefore I am. And he made this distinction, said, well, there's matter on the one hand, and there's the mind on the other hand. And of course, later on, later generations, they said that this was called Descartesian dualism, right? Dualism, because you have two different substances, mind and matter, completely different things. And later generations said, well, but you can't have that. You can't have two completely different substances that function together. Because that's what's happening, right? We have mind. Mind is, I can feel mind somehow in here. And there's body, and it functions together, right? That's what makes us human, mind and matter functioning together. But they said, how can these things function together if they are completely separate? There must be an overlap, right? Somehow, they must be able to interact with each other. If they don't interact with each other, there is no way that these things can actually function as a human being or as an animal. So they discarded this idea of Descartes, this dualist idea was discarded. And they said, no such thing is possible. And then when you come to the Buddha's teachings, these people say, and this is a very common philosophical argument against the idea of rebirth in Buddhism. So that's why I'm bringing it up. People say, you guys, you're just dualists. You believe in mind over here and physical reality over here. But as any philosophical kind of 101 student would know, this is impossible because no interaction is possible between two completely separate elements, right? So, ergo, you have been refuted, there can be no rebirth. That is kind of the idea behind this. But basically, what it rests on, this idea that has been around in Buddhist philosophy for centuries, and it is imposed on Buddhism without really understanding what Buddhism is about. Because Buddhism isn't like that. Buddhism doesn't distinguish between the body on the one hand and the mind on the other hand in that way at all. In Buddhism, these two things are much more interlinked. And just to take a classical example from the suttas and from Buddhism generally, when you die, it's not as if it's just the mind leaving the body. When you die, you're actually bringing with you a physical reality as well at the same time. It's not exactly the same physical reality as this one, but you still have a perception of having a body, right? These are not, in other words, we're not talking in Buddhism about two completely separate substances. We're talking about things that still have a very strong link to each other. So you have to sort of know your Buddhism to be able to see whether these Western physical distinctions actually are applicable to the Buddha's teachings. And I say they're not applicable at all. That is kind of on a very simple level, but on a deeper level, it is just also how we approach the world as Buddhists is so different. This distinction between mind and body is just not a distinction we make as Buddhists. Here, this is just purely a philosophical idea, a philosophical speculation, if you like, about two distinct entities. Buddhism is always based on experience. We're coming from experience. And if you look at the world from experience, rather than looking at it from a theoretical framework, everything looks very different. What is it like to experience something? When you experience the world, there is very little distinction between matter and mind, right? We have perceptions. We understand the world through the mind. How do we perceive matter? We perceive matter through a sense of hardness, right? Something here. We perceive matter through seeing forms. We can see forms around here. We see matter in this way. We can feel perhaps temperature. That is a material thing. But it is perception. It is part of the mind. That's how we actually experience the material world. And in the same way, we also experience the mental world in exactly the same way. The mental world is also based on perception. When you have a dream, again, you can see forms, right? Just we can see forms with a physical eye. But you're now in the mental world rather than the physical world. There's no absolute distinction between mind and the external world. And even if you go deeper into meditation and the world becomes very purified and very simple, you still perceive the world, you understand what is there through your perceptions. So experience, in experience, there is no hard and fast distinction between mind and the external world. And this is the difference between the scientific understanding of the world, where you are focusing on matter, and the Buddhist idea of the world, where you are focusing on experience instead. You're coming from a different point of view. And suddenly, when you come from a different point of view, it's as if that whole distinction dissolves. And it's not really real. It doesn't exist anymore. And I think that science probably has a lot to learn from Buddhism in this area. Science is now, as I said before, it considers the mind a hard problem. And it's actually science which has this dualistic problem. Because science is stuck in matter, right? Matter is here. And it cannot understand the mind. Because the mind, as far as science is concerned, is something completely different. Mind is your subjective experience, right? What does it feel like to have a mind? You're feeling things. You're seeing things. You're experiencing things. You have awareness. It's a subjective something inside of you. And science is not able to bridge that gap between the material world and the inner experience of a human being. And that is a problem that science has. But as Buddhists, we don't actually have that problem. So you can see here, as you look at these criteria that is often used, they actually don't really apply. As far as I can see, they don't really apply to Buddhism. And this is the problem, I think, often when we come from theory, when we come from ideas, often we just get it wrong because we're not able to apply those theories in an appropriate way to what we are looking at. So for me, when I consider the idea of rebirth, I think it is much more important to sometimes, rather than theorizing too much, look at some of the evidence that is out there, in particular some of the anecdotal evidence. And there is a lot of anecdotal evidence that there is such a thing as rebirth. So what is the most powerful anecdotal evidence that there is rebirth? To me, the most powerful one, perhaps it will seem surprising to you, but for me the most powerful one is the Buddha's own words. There's no doubt that the Buddha was a historical person. There's no doubt that he spoke certain discourses 2,500 years ago. And he said that there is rebirth, right? Not only did he say that there is rebirth, but it's absolutely fundamental part of his teachings. Sometimes people say, oh, rebirth, it just came kind of part of the cultural India at the time, you know, had nothing much to do with the Buddha. He just took it on board because he had to take it on board because this was his culture. That is just complete nonsense as far as I'm concerned. It's very clear that it is a central aspect of the Buddha's teachings. The core teachings of Buddhism talk about rebirth. The Four Noble Truths, Second Noble Truth, cause of suffering, it is a craving that leads to rebirth. Third Noble Truth, that craving that leads to rebirth, that must end for you to end suffering. First Noble Truth, birth is suffering, right? We're trying to end suffering. That birth must refer to rebirth in the future. It's the only way you can end that suffering. Fourth Noble Truth of the path. The very first factor is about the idea of right view. Seeing the world in terms of rebirth and karma. I should maybe say that when we talk about right view in Buddhism, it's not like a straitjacket, like, you know, this is what you have to say as a Buddhist. I believe in rebirth. And if you don't say that, you can't be a Buddhist. That's not the point there. The point is that the Buddha says, I have seen this. Now, this is what I have seen. This is how the world functions. So please take it seriously. For your own good, take it seriously. At least investigate it. That is essentially how I understand the idea of right view. Just the Buddha presenting the world as he sees it. So the point here is that this idea of rebirth is absolutely fundamental. It goes throughout the Buddha's teachings. You can't separate it out. If you try to separate it out, the whole thing comes collapsing down and there's nothing left. So what that means, if you do have some respect for the Buddha's teachings, if you do find the Buddha's teachings inspiring and interesting, it means that you should take this idea of rebirth seriously. It doesn't mean that you have to say, I believe, because that's not really a Buddhist way of approaching things. That's more often to do with theistic religions. But it's more to do, take it seriously, right? At least consider it. Don't reject it out of hand. Don't think that, yeah, I know much better. If the Buddha said so, you know, this is a remarkable person, 2,500 years ago, who was able to teach a message in a culture, in an environment that is so completely different from our own. And still today, when you read these teachings, they still have an impact on us, right? This amazing spiritual teacher who was able to say things that are universally true across cultures, across time. Something that speaks directly to us today. It deserves a fair hearing when somebody like that says that there is such a thing as rebirth. And that is the Buddhist approach. You can no longer afford to dismiss it out of hand and say it is nonsense when somebody like the Buddha says it's true. It is absolutely a core teaching of the Buddhist teachings. And this is where I feel that if you go to the secular Buddhists, when they reject the rebirth idea, or sometimes they say they are agnostic, then they come up with all these arguments why it can't possibly be true. That's where I feel they go too far. They go too far because they are throwing out a very significant and important part of the Buddha's teachings. You can't throw this out without destroying the whole idea of what the Buddha's teachings are about. At the very least, you have to take this seriously. Sometimes the so-called secular Buddhists, they say that, well, you know, rebirth doesn't really matter anyway, right? Whether you believe in it or not, it is still the same. No, it isn't the same. If you believe in rebirth, it has tremendous implications. And let's look at those implications very quickly. Now, one of the most important implications, if you have an idea of rebirth, is the idea that you have to take your mind with you into the future, right? So the mind that you have now, this is what you will take into your future life. So if that is what is important, if that is true, it certainly changes your idea, your priorities, or what is important in life changes enormously. If this mind of mine is what I will take into the future, then let me make sure that I take a beautiful mind with me into the future life so I can find happiness where I am in the future. Let me not destroy this mind. Let me not dirty it by doing all kind of bad deeds and stupid things. Let me purify it. Let me make it beautiful that in the future I can enjoy the fruits of all that purification I did in this life, right? That is the right way of looking at the world once you come to some acceptance of the idea of rebirth. It has tremendous implications. It means that most of the things that people value in this life, we still do them, but we see that this is not really that important anymore. What is important is look at the long run, how this actually pans out over the long run. And we put much more effort into purifying and developing this mind in this particular life. And of course, it gives tremendous benefits in this life as well. But suddenly, you have this big picture view of these things. So it matters enormously whether you believe in rebirth. That's the first thing. And of course, the second thing from the Buddhist point of view, and this is where the whole idea of Buddhist liberation and Buddhist freedom comes in, that if you understand rebirth, and there comes a point when you say, enough, I've had enough of all this. I don't want to keep on going around and around in this thing forever. And the way the Buddha explained, this is another very powerful understanding of how important rebirth in the Buddha's teaching is. The Buddha explains what happens as you are approaching awakening in Buddhism. This is called the three higher knowledges in Buddhism. The first of these three higher knowledges is the recollection of your own past life. What does the Buddha say about that? He says it's like someone turning on the light. Right? You've been in darkness until now. It's like turning on the light for the first time you can actually see. And then he says the same thing for the awakening experience itself. That is also like turning on the light. So he's almost like equating the idea of seeing your past life with awakening itself. Both of them are like turning on the light. Because now you understand. Now you see what this samsara, what this life and death is all about. And only when you understand can you take the appropriate action to do something about it. If you don't understand, you can't even do the right thing, right? It's like turning on the light. Then he says somewhere else, he says it's like a chick which is kind of trying to get out of his shell, right? Getting born. And it's just the same thing. When you see rebirth for the first time, when you see your past lives for the first time, it's like a little chick breaking out of his shell and seeing the world for the first time. It's a powerful simile. You are enclosed in this tiny little space, right? You can't see anything. You have nothing around you. All you see is the shell around you, every side. And suddenly it all opens up and you see the world. And again, that is what it's like to understand the idea of rebirth. And again, it is equated with the same simile as for awakening itself. It is, in other words, from a Buddha's point of view, it is an extremely powerful experience. It opens up your view and makes you understand the world in a new way. This is how important it is. And it is so important, in part, because it gives you the broader view, but also in part, because once you understand this, you understand that you actually want to move towards an even more profound liberation. This whole idea of rebirth is not something that you want to keep on doing forever into the future. So, these things are extremely important from the Buddhist point of view, and when a secular Buddhist wants to kind of throw them out and say, enough of this, then you're missing the whole point of the Buddha's teachings. And you're kind of diminishing them. You're reducing them into something much less than they actually are. They have this beautiful message, a beautiful way of looking at the world. And we need to take that, at the very least, we need to take it seriously and look at it carefully. We can't just reject it out of hand. So that is the first one, the first thing that I think is very important. The second thing that the secular Buddhists often dismiss, rebirth being the first one, the second one that they dismiss is the whole idea of awakening, that there is such a thing, that you can awaken to a more profound truth. And they say, you know, this sort of thing we don't believe in because it sounds to us like we can't relate to this, right? It's kind of beyond our own experience. So we throw out the whole idea of awakening here. And again, to me, that's a terrible thing. It's such a beautiful idea that the Buddhist teaching actually leads a path to the ending of all suffering here. Isn't that a beautiful idea? That you can actually move towards something like that? And we know in our lives, even if you can move a little bit towards reduction of suffering, even if you can able to change your character a little bit, to become a more happy and contented person, more kind-hearted, more compassionate in the world, what a liberation that is, just to move in that direction. What a wonderful feeling that is. And this idea that the Buddha says that it's actually possible to make a complete end to suffering, to me is like this bringer of hope, right? This bringer of light. And again, because the Buddha said so, and because to me the Buddha is such a powerful spiritual genius in the world, we owe it to him to take it seriously. It's not something we can just throw out and say is impossible. Rather, let's practice this path. See where it goes. And as the suffering lessens, as the happiness increases, you can start to feel for yourself that maybe there is some truth to this, right? We're certainly moving in the right direction. How far can we take this? And as you move in the right direction, as perhaps you go on a meditation retreat and you find that you get some deep meditation experiences, You start to see the world in an entirely new way. You start to see the world where you are free from the normal sufferings in life, and you see something much more profound. But this, even these kind of basic meditation experiences, is often left out if you profess this idea of secular Buddhism. It's very rare that they talk about deep meditation. Usually, they just talk about mindfulness practice, kind of being mindful in daily life, try not to be so angry. It's an incredibly, in my opinion, this is my opinion, very, very diminished form of Buddhism that you have in the secular Buddhist view. And the last thing that disappears and goes out of the window with a secular Buddhism is, of course, the monastic Sangha, right? That goes out the window as well. If you're just going to be happy in ordinary life, just be mindful, just try to be a nice guy and a nice girl, not try to do too many wrong things, and you're going to be moral and have mindfulness, you don't really need to be a monastic to do those things. So monasticism kind of goes out the window. Monasticism is often very, very closely related to awakening, because the monastic path is one which approaches the idea of awakening. You live away from society, you live away from sensual pleasures, and you're finding your happiness somewhere else. You're finding your happiness in meditation. So the monastic life is a pointer towards something more profound. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why monastic life is actually so important, because it gives a feeling that there is something more in the world, something profound, a happiness that lies outside of the happiness that most people experience in life. But if you take away awakening, you tend to take away monasticism at the same time. But if you have awakening there, this idea of a happiness that lies outside of the ordinary world, then monasticism also starts to make sense. So, I'm not going to say anything more. I think we have a bit of time before the lion dance comes. I could talk about a few more topics, but before I do that, let me just very briefly summarize that I don't think that there is any need for a distinction in this world between secular Buddhism and traditional Buddhism. I think it is very unfortunate we have enough separation, enough divisions as we have already. I don't think we need another division. And actually, I think, to be perfectly honest, that the idea of secular Buddhism is not Buddhism at all. You have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. You have thrown out things that are so fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. You don't have Buddhism anymore. These people can maybe call themselves secularists with a bit of inspiration from Buddhism. That would be more correct. But to call themselves secular Buddhists, I think, is a misnomer. That is the one side of the coin. And the other side of the coin, I'm not sure if as ordinary Buddhists, traditional Buddhists or ordinary Buddhists, that we really need to consider ourselves as religious in the first place. Is Buddhism a religion? I gave you many reasons before for why I don't think it is a religion. So on the one hand, there are some aspects in Buddhism, the idea of Nibbana, of a kind of highest goal, which perhaps is religious in a certain sense. But there are also many things in Buddhism which are not religious in the ordinary sense of the word. So we can choose. We can basically call ourselves what we want, right? So perhaps what we should think about is what is good marketing, right? Now, what is good marketing? How will people come to like this idea of Buddhism? Because I think it's a wonderful teaching, so I'd like to market it well. And sometimes I say, it's not a religion, it's okay. All you have to do is to be kind, act well, and we have this beautiful path that leads to a reduction and perhaps the end of suffering. Do you see any religion in that? And people say, no, okay, there you are. So we don't have to market it as a religion. And I think that is quite useful, because in our modern world, religion is often kind of looked down upon a little bit. Religion is bad, right? So if we don't have to be part of that badness, great, right? So let's not be part of that badness. However, if you do feel that Buddhism has enough religious connotations to it, then of course, then if you feel that, you're also allowed to define it as a religion. There is no standard definition. We can basically choose our definition as it is in the world. And that can be quite handy sometimes. So that is my conclusion on whether Buddhism actually is a religion and whether it's not. And the idea that I don't think we need another division in Buddhism. And we are all, in a way, secular Buddhists. And in another way, we are perhaps all also religious Buddhist. So thank you. Okay. So, should we have some questions? I think we have to hang around for the line dance anyway, so if you want to have a bit of fun and games, then hang in there. And in the meantime, we can just talk about whatever, about any questions you may have, anything like that. Anybody want to say anything here? This is your chance. Remember the Buddha's ancient saying. This is always good, handy to remember. If you have to have an inquisitive mind, and if you have an inquisitive mind that asks questions, you will be wise in a future life, right? So if you believe, if you don't believe in rebirth, you don't have to worry. But if you believe in rebirth, you better ask questions. Hutong. Okay. Yeah.
Ajahn, this question is totally out of my curiosity,
yeah.
And probably respect for you as well. May I know the meaning of your name?
My name?
Yes.
Okay, it's not really related to the topic, is it? But okay, well maybe it is, you never know what comes out. But no, the meaning of my name, it's very funny because when I chose my name, I thought, okay, I'm going to be a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. So I choose something that sounds a bit like Ajahn Brahm. Right? So I chose Brahmali. What was my name? But as it turned out, when I actually looked at this name later on, I actually found out it means exactly the same as Brahmavangso. It's exactly the same meaning. So Vangso, Brahmavangso, Vangso means like lineage or family. So it means like the lineage of Brahma. That's exactly what Brahmali means as well. It means the lineage, family of Brahma. Yeah. So the idea in Buddhism of Brahma, Brahma is like one of the high gods in the Buddhist kind of idea of different god realms, right? And it's a place where you can get reborn when you have a very, very pure mind, a very pure heart. It's where there is metta, it's where there is compassion, it's when you have like jhana and samadhi states, that's where you get reborn. So if you are the lineage of Brahma, it's like you have to kind of live up to that, that standard, right? So you have to have lots of metta and compassion and kindness. That's basically what it, the idea behind that. Yeah. You happy with that? Yeah. There's another topic that I wanted to talk about as well tonight, but I didn't really feel I had the time. And that is, please ask questions if you like, anyone. If not, I'll just keep talking on random stuff.
There's a question
stuff.
Here.
Please, down there. Yes, Miri.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the talk. I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I've been having a few debates about rebirth with various people, and there is a particular question that can often come up in response to the kind of line which you've put forth, and that is there's some sutra, I can't remember where the Buddha said, don't take anything on faith, purely if you have to experience it for yourself.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a tension there because most people, unless they've got very advanced states of meditation, have not experienced rebirth or karma. So how would you respond to that? Because somebody might say that, well, that makes Buddhism a religion because you're having to take on faith, rebirth and karma.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And that is, I know, is very much the kind of the secular viewpoint that tend to quote that kind of suttas. So that's very much the case. The first thing I would say, you don't have to take rebirth on faith in the Christian. I mean, the problem is that we live in a society that is permeated by Christian terminology. So when we use the word faith, we use it in the Christian way. That's not how it applies in Buddhism. The Buddha didn't say that you must believe in rebirth, otherwise get out of here. He didn't say anything like that, right? What the Buddha said, and in many suttas, he says that, well, even if you don't believe in rebirth, it's still good to be moral, right? This is one of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. But I say that there is rebirth. In other words, he says it on his personal authority that it is rebirth. And then when you are in the company with somebody like the Buddha, you think, wow, okay, I better believe this, right? If this guy says that, I can't just dismiss it anymore. And this is what I feel also in the present day, when you know a lot of people in the present Buddhist world, people who are very well practiced, who obviously have very deep meditation, if you know them very well. And when these people come to your face and say, there is rebirth, you can't dismiss it anymore. It becomes impossible because this is a person who you just trust so much. It is impossible to dismiss it anymore. You may not believe it 100%, but you can't dismiss it out of hand. It is so powerful when these things come face to face to you like that. It's so powerful and so hard to reject this issue when that happens. There was also another example which I thought was very powerful. There was one of the members of the Buddhist Society here. I'm digressing a bit from the question, but I'll get back to it in a second, Miri. Sorry about that. But there was a member here of the Buddhist Society who had this past life regression therapy, and he was looking into his past life, and he had a very, very powerful experience, and he spoke to his regressionist about this experience, and he had a memory of a past life right here in WA. And so he went to this place that he remembered, and he went there, and when he got there, he sort of said, oh, there's something funny about this, because there was a house there, right? The house wasn't here, it used to be over there. He told me this personally, right? So I was actually with this person. And it turns out that, yes, when he, before, you know, a few decades ago, the house actually was in this other place. It's a kind of story that you read about in some of these journals. But here, the guy was telling to me face to face. And he is not the kind of space cadet, or whatever they call it. You know, kind of people with kind of all kind of weird ideas. He's a very down-to-earth, proper person. I know him quite well. And I was astonished when I heard this story. It just sounds, it's very powerful. But to get back to your question about this idea that we can't take things on faith. Well, of course, the most important sutta for that is the Kallama Sutta. It also occurs a few other places in the suttas. But it is not a teaching that occurs in many, many different places. It's not a massive emphasis of the Buddha. You have to remember the context of the Kallama Sutta. The Kallamas are people who are really confused, right? They have been visited by all these different teachings and say, oh, we hear this teaching, we hear that teaching. Yeah. This religious teacher comes to us, another religious teacher comes to us. Who should we believe? Which one is right? So they're basically very confused people. And then the Buddha says, well, don't take anything on faith. Don't accept things just because a monk says so, or a nun says so, or a guru says so. Don't accept it because it's tradition. Don't accept it for whatever reason. When you know that something is good, then you should do it. When you know that something is bad for yourself, then reject it. That's what he says to these very confused people. And that is basically the context there. So the Buddha has this very large framework where he allows people to question, right? Then he also says in many other contexts, he says, this is my experience. This is right view. This is actually how the world works. So I recommend you to take these things seriously. I don't think there's a clash between these things at all. I think that these things actually go together very, very beautifully here. So you start off on the path as a confused Kallama, and then gradually, as you start to see that these things work, you gain a degree of confidence that maybe there's something more profound going on here. And that's when you can take on confidence the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Hugh. Yeah. Anybody else who would like to say anything here? Over there, yes?
I have heard from some Buddhist people that they believe that you don't have to come back in the human form, that you can come back as an animal or a tree. I find that really very difficult to relate to, as we take our mind with us.
Yeah.
Surely we are here to evolve as human beings towards a better life. And so I'd just like you to comment on that, please.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so yes, there is indeed, that's quite right. According to Buddhism, you can be kind of reborn in many different realms, different places. And one, I think, nice way of understanding that is that the human realm, there's only so much scope for happiness and suffering, right? Even the poorest person in the world has a certain degree of happiness. Even the most wealthy kind of Bill Gates or whatever is going to have their fair share of suffering. There's only a certain scope in the Buddhist world. From the Buddhist point of view, there's only a certain scope of happiness and suffering in the human realm. Now, if you make kamma, if you act in such a way, you purify your mind in such a way that you are kind of due more happiness that is within this narrow scope, you can no longer be reborn in the human realm. So you're going to be reborn somewhere else to be able to experience that happiness which is your due according to your kamma. So basically the idea of rebirth in other realm is just an expansion of that narrow ability to experience happiness and suffering that exists in the human realm. So if you get reborn in what is sometimes called the heavenly realm, it sounds weird. It sounds like, what is that? But it's just you, right? It's just you there again in a place where there's just more happiness than you can have in the human realm. So it's an expansion of those possibilities that you have in the human realm. And the same thing on the suffering side, because the human realm can only give you so much suffering. If you are due more suffering, then you will be reborn somewhere beyond that. So to look at come back to your question about we are here as human beings to evolve. That is true. If you practice in the right way, then you are here to evolve, right? Because you're doing what is good. You're purifying yourself. You're practicing the right way. But not all beings take that opportunity. It might be that they should evolve. It might be that they should be doing what is right so they actually can experience more happiness. But many beings do the opposite. Instead of taking that potential which exists in the human realm to go somewhere pleasant, do something good, they do the opposite and they do bad things instead. And because of that, they're not evolving at all. They are like devolving or going the wrong direction. And of course, that is when it is possible to move towards something that is more suffering in the future than you can experience in the human realm. And to take your example of the animal rebirth, that is also possible. Tree rebirth is not possible according to Buddhism, but animal rebirth is. And to understand that, there is a nice idea about how rebirth functions, which is often has often been mentioned in certain circles. And rebirth can be considered it's almost like when you move into a body, that physical body places constraints on your mind, right? So as a human being, you are constrained by your physical body. Your brain has a certain capacity, your body has a certain capacity, and your mind is constrained by that. And this is why deep meditation, when you're kind of leaving your physical body behind and you're releasing the mind from the physical aspects, that's why in deep meditation you can see things that you cannot see as part of your physical body. Because you are removing yourself from the constraints of the physical body. It's like your mind is no longer filtered through your physical body. And the same thing is happening in the animal realm. The problem in the animal realm is that it is still your mind, still you, which moves on into that direction. But the problem is that now your mind is filtered through that animal body and that animal brain. And because it's filtered through that, it is like it is limited and imprisoned in something very limited. And that, I think, is a good way to understand how rebirth can happen in these realms.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir. Have we got the microphone over here, please? Yeah.
Thank you. I've never understood how my dog can be reborn as a human, how he can have a better life, or conversely...
Sorry, could you please repeat that?
How my dog could be reborn as a human.
Your dog, yeah?
Yes.
How your dog can be reborn as a human.
How an animal can create good karma.
Okay. Okay, I think it is often it's not easy necessarily once you're reborn as a dog, it may be very hard sometimes to get reborn in the human realm again. But I think the best thing for you to do is just to be kind to your dog, right? Treat it really, really well. Be very kind to it. Dog feels happy. If you feel happy inside, that is when you have a chance of a good rebirth, right? If you treat a dog badly, the dog feels miserable. I think one of the things, I mean, being a dog owner, you probably know this better than me because I never had a dog in my whole life, but you probably know that animals have emotions, right? I'm sure you know that as a dog owner. And a dog can be happy, a dog can be sad, a dog can be kind of depressed and distressed and all these kind of things. So you know that its mind state will depend on how you treat it. So treat it with enormous kindness, with enormous love, and then I think you're giving your dog the maximum chance of a good rebirth in the future. Okay. Okay. Good. Yes. Alana, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Some animals rescue humans from disastrous situations.
Yep.
Is it possible that those particular animals may possibly be reborn as humans?
Yes, I suppose that is the case. I mean, it's a wonderful thing that happens. You know, you see these things. There's obviously an intention there to help somebody else. It's a very wonderful thing that happens. Sometimes you hear the most amazing stories. I know Ajahn Brahm tells a story about a crocodile, apparently, in Sri Lanka, who actually rescued somebody and brought them to the shore. We normally think of crocodiles as very cold-hearted. There's nothing there. But he actually rescued somebody, brought them to the shore during the tsunami in 2004 or whatever it was. So I think that may well be the case. It may well actually happen because it may leave an imprint on your mind. But I think one of the problems for animals is that as a human, we have more awareness. So when you do an act of goodness, because of that awareness you have, it makes more of an impact on your mind. Because it makes more of an impact on your mind, it's easy for you to recollect it. And that's why it has more karmic consequences. Animals generally have a more dull awareness, and because of that duller awareness, the karma often leaves less imprint on the mind. Okay, let's go. Should I take this? Yeah, I'd better take the questions from overseas, because... Are they here now? Oh, okay, so quick questions from overseas. The first one is from Dira Yupa from Thailand. Hello, Dira Yupa. I know Dira Yupa very well, so it's that's always nice. Okay, so how can we overcome our doubt about the law of karma when we see that in our society, good people suffer and corrupt people flourish? Although Buddhism says that the law of karma encompasses many lifetimes, it's still difficult to have faith. We are the heir to our karma. We, being defiled, need to see solid evidence in this lifetime. Okay. Don't look, all those corrupt people, maybe they flourish on the outside, but what do they look inside in their hearts? If they really are corrupt, if they really are bad people, their heart is not beautiful, right? And we know that. I know that. When I do an act of kindness, I feel good inside. I think all of us know that experience. You do something kind, and afterwards you feel joy because of that kindness, right? I think everybody has experienced that every now and again. And the more you accumulate those acts of kindness, the more you accumulate also the joy inside of you. So look at your mind. Don't look at external things. Don't think in terms of wealth or in terms of social position, all these kind of things. Look at what's actually happening in your mind. And then you understand the law of karma. And this is what it's about. It's about building up this goodness inside, purifying yourself. And then when you die, you find yourself at a higher level than when you were born, right? This is what life really is about. And then you feel, I haven't wasted my life. I've spent my life in a good way. And you actually feel the difference. The corrupt guy or the corrupt girl, perhaps, who have done something really dodgy, or they have, you know, I don't know what they do, these people, but whatever they have done, they will find themselves in a lower place when they die. Imagine your mind being more dark, more miserable, more sad when you die than when you came into this world. Isn't that terrible? And then when you die, that's all you are left with. All the power, all the material things that you used to get through your corruption, whatever it is, all that is gone. And all you are left with is the negative consequences of your corruption, the negative consequences on your mind. Now then you understand that you have completely got the wrong end of the stick. You haven't understood what you should really be doing. But sometimes when you die, it's too late, right? So let's get this straight right away here, so we don't get that wrong. So look at your mind. What happens when you do something kind? And feel that. Then you understand the law of karma. Okay. Question number two. This is Nick from the USA. Are microorganisms such as viruses, bacteria, part of Buddhist cosmology? Do they have five aggregates? Good question. I haven't got a clue whether how many aggregates they have. I think the only way that we can ever solve that question is that we have to find out whether these beings have feelings, right? We have to take a needle and prod it slightly and see if it recoils in pain or what it does. Or we have to do something with it to see if it moves away or if it is afraid. And if we can see that these little beings actually have feelings, that they can feel something, well then yes, they do have five khandhas, and they are part of the Buddhist cosmology. But I think it is a very open question. And I don't really know. Traditionally, in Buddhism, we talk about panatipata virapmani, which is the first Buddhist precept, to abstain from killing living beings. Pana means breathing beings, right? And breathing, normally we're talking about lungs. Of course, these organisms too breathe in a certain sense, that they use oxygen, but not in the ordinary sense of animals. So it's an open question. So it's up to you, Nick, to get a, I don't know what you are, whether you are a biologist perhaps. If you are a biologist, go and do some experiments, and please come back to us if you find out the answer to this question. It's actually quite an interesting question, I find. So let us know what happens. Okay, question number three, before we start the line dancing. This is from Russell from Hawaii. Hello, Russell. Russell is another old friend of ours. When people are not willing to put effort in the practice, do you feel that they seek an easy way to Nibbana by misunderstanding the teachings and completely discard the core teachings of the Buddha? Yes, I think, of course, the reason why people don't put in enough effort in their practice is basically because they haven't got enough confidence in the Buddhist path, right? If you have a very powerful confidence that this teaching actually works, if you have a confidence that there is something that needs to be done, something that needs to be discarded, that there is a movement towards happiness and the giving up of suffering, the more powerful your confidence, the more energy you have for the practice. And this is found in the five spiritual faculties, right? The five spiritual faculties, they start off with confidence, and confidence gives rise to energy. That is where the practice comes in. So this is why I think it is so important to get a good understanding of what Buddhism is about, to read the suttas, read the word of the Buddha, and then find out what happens when you do that. Some people find out, I reject this, I don't believe in all this stuff. And that's fine, at least you know what you're rejecting. But other people, and I think many people find that, when they read of the word of the Buddha, there's a confidence that arises with that. It says that this is something powerful and beautiful. And because of that, it then drives the energy, right? From sadha comes virya, from confidence comes that energy. So do the homework, read the teachings, inspire yourself, listen to good Dhamma talks that inspire you, and then that will drive your path forward. This is one of the wonderful things about being a Buddhist monastic. You live in an environment, in a monastery, which helps to drive your practice forward, because you are surrounded by good Kalyanamitas. So make sure that you get your input from Kalyanamitas, which is of course the Buddha, and then any other Dhamma teachings that you enjoy. But I feel a sense of excitement here, so maybe now is the time to stop, and then we can move on to the lion dancing. So, great.